Hey gang, I'm here to tell you about Stitcher. Stitcher's smart radio on-demand news, talk, and more for your mobile phone. Stitcher brings radio and podcast listeners a better way to listen to their favorite shows and helps them discover new content by delivering personalized audio streams on-demand right to your smartphone. How Did I Get Here, along with 5,000 other shows, is on Stitcher. Listen to us on your iPhone, Android phone, BlackBerry, or your various pads. Stitcher smart radio for your phone. Find it in your app store at Stitcher.com. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Let's get down. And you may ask yourself, well, how did I get here?
It's time for How Did I Get Here?
Hello, I'm Johnny. I'm your host. Welcome to the show. I have a great show for you today. My guest is musician and artist, visual artist, Chris Taylor. He is a guy that lives in San Antonio. I've known him for a few years. We've done a couple of shows together, I think, and then, I've seen him here and there. He's a great guy, very nice. He reached out, told me about some music he had done. I checked it out. I said, hey, let's get together. It turned out I was going to Bernie, Texas the next day, which is right outside of San Antonio. So we met up there between soundcheck and the gig. We sat down, we talked. He gave me his whole story. It's pretty awesome. And then he gave me a beautiful gift, a painting, and a personalized painting, which now hangs here in my studio. How Did I Get Here Studios? That's what I call it. How Did I Get Here Studios? All right, so we will get to the conversation with Chris Taylor in just a minute. Let me tell you what's going on with me. I am in a weird step-parent thing. I guess I'm doing this the day before it comes out, so it's Thursday to me, although it's Friday, might be Friday to you. So tonight, Skyrocket's playing at Steiner Ranch. My ex-stepdad is coming out, right? He was married to my mom for a short period of time from when I was like, he was with my mom from when I was like 3 or something, so I was like 7. And then tomorrow, my ex-stepmom is coming out. My dad was with her from when I was like 7 or 6 or something till I was, in my 20s. Weird, huh? Odd. Two step-parent things, in from out of town, seeing shows at Skyrocket Shows tomorrow, House of Blues. So if you're listening to this today, which is Friday, September 27th, 2013, Skyrocket is playing in Houston at the House of Blues Bronze Peacock Room. Come on out to that, 9:30. Should be a fun time. My ex-stepmom will be there. You can say hi to her. So speaking of that, I played on Tuesday. You heard me talk about it at the Ham Benefit Day, the William Harry's Graham thing over at Maria's Taco Express. And a bunch of bands played. It was really great. But my ex-stepdad surprised me. He showed up, and he was with a couple of guys that he knew from a long time ago. One guy I knew from when I was a little kid, this guy Fred. So then we went over to this other guy's house and shot pool for a while and got caught up after the thing. And it was great. It was great hanging out with him and reconnecting. He's a great guy, and I don't ever see him. So all of a sudden, like boom, he comes in. And there was this whole 4-year period of my life where he was with my mom. He's married to her, and we were part of each other's families, and we lived together and did stuff together. And he bought me an Erector set and stuff. So it was great. It was great catching up, and it brings back warm feelings from my childhood, which is good. Good times. We were on the same team shooting pool together, and we lost to the other guys 3 times. So that happened, and it was great catching up. So blast from the past. Going to see him again tonight. See the ex-stepmom tomorrow. So do that. Whew, family times. All right. My guest today is singer-songwriter, visual artist, and illustrator, Chris Taylor. He lives in San Antonio, Texas. He was the lead singer of a band called Love Coma in the 90s. He's been performing as a solo artist ever since they broke up. And his 2000 album, Worthless Pursuit of Things on Earth, was nominated as Rock Album of the Year for the 2001 Dove Awards. He just released a new album called Postcards from the End of Time in April 2013. And he continues making art. He made me a very special piece of art, which hangs now in my studio, which I have to thank him for. A very personalized piece of art. Has my name on it. How Did I Get Here? And everything. Fan of the show. Great guy. I've known him. We've done some shows together. He's friends of people I know. And I believe I know his wife from a long time ago. I don't know if we talked about that in the interview, but I think that. Anyway, he's a fantastic guy. He's always been really nice. He's a great, great songwriter. He's done some work with Dave Stewart. And we talk about that. We have a great, great, great conversation. I was in Bourne, Texas, Bernie, Texas. Just outside of San Antonio, and we got together in between my sound check and gig. So it was a great conversation. Enjoy it. My friend, Chris Taylor, let's get down. How did you meet Dave Stewart?
Seriously, I heard about this thing called Twitter, and I was like, oh, mm-hmm. Let me, you know, I just ditched my MySpace. I was doing this Facebook thing. I know nothing about social media, you know what I mean? I was just like, okay, I'm in a band. I'm a musician. I better get with this thing.
Yeah.
And so I was doing Facebook, and I heard about Twitter, and I thought, all right, let me get on Twitter. So I had spent a few weeks on Twitter trying to wrap my head around it, figure out, like, I realized real quick my life wasn't interesting enough to be on Twitter, but in that short time space, I stumbled upon Dave Stewart, and I was like, oh, he was the guy in the Eurythmics, mm-hmm. And that's all I knew. It was sort of like, you know, the other guy from Wham, or the other guy, like, Oates from Hall & Oates. I thought Eurythmics was Annie Lennox, and he was the other guy.
Right.
But I knew I loved the Eurythmics, and I thought, all right, I'm going to find out what this guy's up to now. And I realized instantly that he was a genius, this creative wizard that is so unknown.
You didn't remember him sort of being in the Don't Come Around Here No More and being part of that
whole I knew that
extravaganza,
but I just didn't know, like, the stories behind it. I was too, like, at that time I was just like a sponge, but I wasn't aware of who I loved or not. I just loved everything.
I'm
like, it was music. It was back in the 80s, and that was about the same time my father was making me burn all my secular records, but that's a whole other story. So,
oh, we'll get to that.
Yeah. So, I befriend Dave Stewart and found that it was actually him. It wasn't like
That's the thing about Twitter. It's Steve Martin.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. Pulling out his phone exactly. And going like, you know, this guy's serving me great coffee.
Yep. So within like a week or so, I think after that, he had this the songwriting thing, hey everybody, I'm gonna release this instrumental, and I'm looking for the best vocal melody and lyric to go on top of this instrumental. And I'm like, why not give it a shot? I had maybe 25 minutes. I mean, I could have probably taken more time, but the minute I discovered that, I downloaded this track of music into GarageBand. And I'm listening to it, and I get a text from my wife. She's like, hey, I'm on my way home. Let's go eat. And I'm like, sure. In that time frame, I had a song title called Here and Gone But Everlasting. I had the title.
You work from titles a lot?
Seems to be
easier.
Something hits me, and I don't know if it's going to be a title or if it's going to be like the opening line to a song just something. But Here and Gone But Everlasting, it just was too great of a line to forget. So anyways, I had that. I'm listening to the track, and it was instantly like, I have to write this song now. So by the time my wife left her work and got to the house, I had to text her and say, I'm doing a vocal. I'm recording a vocal.
Be quiet when you come in.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm recording the vocal. And I wrote the whole song. I'm listening to the instrumental about three times, and I wrote the whole song within that context. I recorded my voice and then like two harmony background vocals, and then did a rough mix and sent it off and was like, all right, and kind of forgot about it because I thought there's no way. I mean, I always get passed over for this kind of stuff. I always get like, oh,
you know what's fucked up? And I'll tell you the truth. I rarely ever do that stuff because I don't even get to the doing it because I think I'm going to get passed over.
Yeah.
Dave Stewart going to want to do that with me.
So I can't remember how long it was between that time frame and then him announcing the winner of this. I didn't know what I was going to win. I didn't care about any of that stuff because I thought,
the winning is you wrote a song with Dave Stewart. Shit.
To me, that's exactly what it was. So, so we were coming back from Austin. We spent like the weekend in Austin. I can't remember what we were doing there, but spent the weekend in Austin. And on the way back, I happened to check Twitter, and it was just like one of those weird, you know, I flipped by and Dave Stewart's tweet said, oh, we're going to announce the winner in, you know, 45 minutes. And then I'm like, oh, and all of a sudden, because I just wanted to have nothing to do with the music business for so long, just because of all the other reasons why every artist doesn't want anything to do with the music business, you know what I mean? So it was just, I was in that same lot where I was just sort of jaded, like a bad girlfriend.
It looks like a lot of us were right, though. Yeah. You know what I mean? Because there's not a lot of business left. Go ahead.
No, but everything I thought that I didn't care about, now I'm all anxious. I got the cold, sweaty hands, and I'm like, oh, what do I care about this for? Like, what does it even matter to me? And so right when we got to our front door of our house, they announced, you know, they said, and the winner is Chris Taylor. And I'm reading it, and I'm like going, it took me like a few seconds to kind of go,
that's me.
That's me, yeah. And it was so surreal. Like, then, like, Dave messages me, and we trade numbers, and then, like, the next day he calls me when I'm eating in the middle of eating a sandwich, and I'm like, all of a sudden he's like, hey, Chris, it's Dave. I just want to let you know, we love the song, and, you know, and I'm just like, and I didn't have time to be starstruck, because I didn't really know who Dave Stewart was.
Right,
it wasn't like I was this Dave Stewart fan all my life.
Right.
But it was, I took a peek into his life to know I'm dealing with a genius here.
Like a
certified genius. And
not only that, but a force. He's like a force.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, he's going. And people jump on and jump off. Yeah. Like, Tom Petty jumped on, Stevie Nicks jumps on. Like, all these people, like, jump on his, like, creative train, you know?
Yeah, because they sense it.
Yeah.
They sense it. They're like, I want a piece of that.
Yeah.
You know, Martina McBride and Dave Stewart are writing music together. It's like, what the heck? You know, like, this eccentric British new wave guy and then, like, country pop music or whatever it is that she's doing. And so it's just such a surreal thing. And the next thing I know, he invites us to his new album release party up in Nashville. So we go up there. And, you know, it's like people are, you know, Kevin Cronin from REO Speedwagon. Everybody's there. Like, all these people are there that I'm going, what the heck am I here? You know.
And, how did I get here?
And then Dave comes out. And it was like in December or something. He comes out in this like Gandalf-like white flowing coat. With a top hat and his dark shades on, you know? And he's at the foot of the stage, and he's like, and my wife and I are standing there amidst all these people that are kind of waiting to talk to him and say hello and congratulate him on, and this is right after the gig, right after his show. And he's like, Chris Taylor, I want everybody to know that this is Chris Taylor, he's a great songwriter from San Antonio. And I'm just sitting there, it's like one of those weird things, like, is this really happening?
It's like all of a sudden, like the
well, you know,
they tapped you. Hey, you're in, buddy.
Yeah.
Here's a room full of people.
It was one of those very, very strange things. And so grateful. And, you know, he doesn't have to say that or anything like that. And then I was in Nashville a few weeks later doing illustrations for a book on a completely different kind of related thing.
Right.
And I get a text message, and it's Dave Stewart texting me. And he's like, Chris, I heard you're in town. Now would be a great time to come, you know, listen to the tracks from the record, you know, kind of a thing. I'm at Blackbird Studios. So I had a friend of mine in Nashville, that is a photographer guy named Alan Clark, who's amazing. And he comes over to the hotel, whisks me away, and the next thing I know, we're ushered into Blackbird Studios, which is owned by Martina McBride, her husband, own this, like, it's a complex. It's like the amazing, amazing play. And I'm walking past like Lionel Richie and Martina McBride's there, and like all these people that have been playing with like Neil Young, and which, you know, you don't know that until all of a sudden you find out all this later. You're like, oh my God, I just had no idea. Yeah. And so they're listening to the final mixes of their album, and it's like celebration and martinis and whatever is flowing. Everything's just happening. It's like, it is like the ultimate rock star bash.
Yeah.
And background singers who sang with Michael Jackson are there. You know, it's like that. And also, like, what the hell am I doing here? Yeah. Like a minute ago, I was alone in a hotel room working on illustrations for a book that may never see the light of day.
And now I'm in rock and roll.
Now I'm in complete rock
and
like
roll. I'm like on a page of random notes in Rolling Stone.
Yeah,
or
like this Fabio looking character is selling or like mixing a drink. And I'm just like, this is so bizarre. And Dave Stewart keeps calling me back into the center of the room next to the console, and he's puts his arm around me, and he's got a martini glass in one hand and his arm around me, and he's handing me the lyric sheets going, what do you love this one, you love this, and I'm just sitting here thinking, like, what did I do to deserve any of this? Like, I wrote some lyrics and sang a tune, and all of a sudden now here I am. And it's so,
but see, isn't that the funny thing, because that's all he does too. That's all anybody, that's all Neil Young does.
Yeah, yeah, I guess so.
Like, he
You're
does
right.
anything magical. Yeah. He just writes some words and a song.
Yeah. So, it was such a great night. And the whole time, I feel like, am I wearing out my welcome? Am I staying, you know?
I know that feeling. You don't say anything? I totally do that. I just had an experience like that in April.
And, but he keeps calling, and now it's like, 2 or 3 in the morning or something, and the party's dying down, and you know, there's about 15-16 people, everybody that played on his records, Martina McBride's in the room, and I don't mean to be name dropping, but it's like a surreal moment. So all of these people that I just are like way in another stratosphere of life and living than I am, and Dave says, hey everybody, have you met everybody know who Chris is.
Is he just wasted at this point too? Or no?
Well, if
he
is,
like, super cool?
He's been so cool. He's in everybody's control. If they're all wasted, they're all like very
pretty
much
cool.
In control, but very laid back. And so he introduces me to everybody, and then he proceeds to play the song that we wrote, Here and Gone But Everlasting. He hooked up his laptop to the big speakers, and it's now blasting over the speakers.
And it's you, what you recorded in your,
it's me,
your vocal.
It's my vocals
and his music.
And his music. And
it's a great song, by the way.
Oh, thank you very much.
It's a really good song.
It's just subtle and it's nothing that says,
it's a good song,
look at me, but it's like this sweet thing. This little sweet little song. I love it. And it's kind of a crazy thing. And that was like, that was what, as a songwriter and as a musician, that, and you tell yourself your whole life, at least I've told myself, oh, I don't need to be validated. I just do what I do. I don't need to be like pat on the back saying, good job, Chris, or we love you, Chris. I don't need any of your, you know, praise or glory. But, and then all of a sudden a moment like that happens. And then the song fades off, you know, the longest and the most amazing 3 minutes and 40 seconds of your life.
Right.
And, you know, in between trying not to piss myself, I would take sneak peeks of people's faces while the song was going on. Yeah. And these musicians who have done it all, played it all, seen it all, heard it all, they're actually like really listening.
Yeah.
And each of them had come up to me afterwards at different times in the evening and was like, man, that was just great. You live here in Nashville, man? Are you doing anything here? And I'm like, I live in San Antonio, where nobody goes.
Did they say, like, man, you got to get up here? Or no?
Nobody came out and said that, but it was like this really great... I felt like if I had said, yeah, I live, like, around the corner or something like that, there would have been... There might have been the possibility for some sort of magic to happen. You just don't know.
Yeah.
But that was that... It was such a beautiful thing that was like... The only thing I could relate it to was if you could, like, put creative inspiration in a syringe and somebody just
sure,
into
yeah.
your arm. It was like I lived off of that night. I think I'm still living off of
and
that
the thing,
night.
And the thing is, too, is it's not like these people's fame that is really that. They're just people at the height. They've gotten into a zone where they are doing work and it's important work to people. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But they're also at a place where they're just putting out. Like, David Stewart is like, I mean, he's just always been like a guy just, you know, stuff just pouring out of him.
Yeah.
And it's so inspiring to be around people like that.
The fact that, you know, and then just this, you know, here's how sweet he is. Like, he's like a really, really sweet guy. Here's how sweet he is. South by Southwest just this past year. My wife and I drove up, and I got a chance to hang with like the Water Boys, which is like my all-time favorite
band.
That's
a dream of mine.
A really, really cool. That's another whole great story. I mean, saw 3 shows in 2 days, really amazing, and was like got the VIP treatment from Mike Scott and Steve Wickham. It was like, I don't deserve this. I don't know why you're giving it to me, but God bless you and thank you. And so we're driving home completely like wonderfully elated and extremely wiped out from that weekend, and I get a text from Dave Stewart, and he's like, "Hey Chris, I'm here with Stevie Nicks, and we're gonna premiere the big film. We'd like, you know, are you in Austin? We'd love to for you to come be a part of it." And I'm like, we were like just coming out of New Braunfels into San Antonio, completely bleary eyed. Like I could barely make it home.
Right, right.
And I'm like, in all of the barrage of South by Southwest, he's stopping what he's doing and texting me.
Yeah.
Like of all people.
What's Chris
in the
doing?
World. Yeah.
What's Chris? Oh, Chris
doing?
He lives in Santa. That's right by Austin. Yeah. That's fucking awesome.
That it's like the most amazing. And I think, and I've never asked anything from him. I never say, "Hey, Dave, let's do a record or let's." Like, there's something about.
You send him stuff though.
I haven't sent him anything.
Drawings or paintings?
I sent him a birthday.
Totally would love that.
I sent him a birthday card.
Okay.
That I created for him.
Okay, good.
You know, so little things like that. But I've never said. Because other people around me are like, "Well, what's going to happen now?" I'm like, "What do you mean, what's going to happen now?" I mean, like, that was everything. That was everything. But I don't think people who aren't musicians get it. They think, "Oh, it's a connection." And
now
I'm like,
"No,
the connection is the joy of of creating or collaboration or getting to or standing next to somebody's fire." You know what I mean? Like getting to soak up Dave Stewart's vibe for one night is
It's worth it.
It's like a master class. You just sit back and soak it in and learn. You know?
Enjoy it.
So yeah.
So what were you were there when you were in Nashville? You were doing some illustrations for a book. Do you do a lot of that stuff? Because you're also a visual artist. You're not just a musician. Not like that's a bad thing. But
no, I'm just now starting to get. It's so weird because I've always done it my whole life, but I'm just now saying, all right, let me get this stuff out there. Let me post this stuff. Let me throw it out there. And because I've posted what I think is just sort of my own little ridiculous, amusing drawings, you know, that I love.
I love them too.
Thank you. All of a sudden, it's like people are contacting me. Like, "Hey, do my album cover. Hey, do this." Or, "Oh, I'd love for you to
it's
be a part
awesome.
Of this." And so it's sort of that... you know, I created this little series of artworks that I call it, and I told myself, "Fight fear, make art," because, you know, the financial fear, the stress of not really quite making it, or never knowing if you're going to make it from month to month, whether it be rent or bills or whatever it is, or what. And I'm like, and I can get really stressed about all those things.
Yeah, we all can. Yeah.
And so I decided, all right, get up and do something about this. So I just started creating this artwork. I would just go buy these canvases and I'd be like, "What am I doing spending money on canvases? I should put this towards bills," you know what I mean? But then there's a little part of me that said, "Well, maybe
people will pick
if
up
I put
on
this
it.
Out
yeah.
there." And so fight fear make art. That's what I put it on.
That's
all
that's an amazing
stuff.
What is that from?
It's that, from my own head.
That's your own. You came up with fight fear
unless it
make
exists
art?
Somewhere else.
No,
have
I mean, that's
no
just
idea.
That's exactly. I mean, you know, as a creative person, you wake up on those days where you, or when you don't make anything for a couple of days, it's like a guy trying to quit smoking. You become a fucking asshole.
Yeah.
Like, you're not getting your hit. Like, where's my thing that I put something out and I can be, you know, I got something out of me.
Yeah.
And I feel like that about what you do. Like, both music and, I mean, I listened to a shitload of your music today. And
sorry about that.
No, it's great. I felt bad that I hadn't listened to all of it before. I mean, you gave me an album when we did a show together like 3 years ago or something, and that's all I had.
Yeah.
But your new album's fantastic.
Thank you.
And all your older stuff is great too. I mean, you have a tremendous amount of output.
Yeah, like I said, it was, I can't remember the turning point in my life, but I just thought, as soon as I knew I was going to have the opportunity to do this on my own, like, instead of waiting for a producer, waiting for, you know, the right
like that.
Gear.
Yeah.
You know, if I could record with Daniel Lanois, you know, in New Orleans with his haunted studios or whatever, that would be great. But I don't think that's going to happen.
No. Or maybe it will.
Write
him on Twitter.
yeah.
So
I just thought, you know, it's time to just learn it and do it yourself. And I taught myself how to play instruments that I never knew how to play. And I just said, like, I don't know if I could play it if somebody else wanted me to in their band, but I'm like,
you can do it on
play
your stuff.
For my own stuff.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That's the kind of drummer I am, I think. Like, I play on my stuff a
cool.
lot.
Yeah.
And, you know, but I would never play in a band.
Too much responsibility,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, and I'm terrible. Yeah. And I probably couldn't make it through two songs. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, physically. Right. That's a hard thing to do. Okay, so where are you from? Where were you born? Let's get into this weird stuff that I'm about
town,
to find out.
Yeah, a little town upstate New York called Oswego. And, you know, I grew up skipping rocks in the Lake Ontario. And that was it for me. I was very much a loner. I had my little nephew who really is only like 4 or 5 years younger than me. But at the time, he seemed so small.
Baby, yeah.
And, but we spent a lot of time together, and I spent a lot of time on my own, and I loved it. It was one of those little towns you can ride your bike around the whole town, or you could play. We have groups of friends, and we'd play this game called Chase, where you could use the whole, it's like hide and go seek, but with groups and in a whole block, you know what I mean?
You could
hide in people's backyards, and they won't shoot you. And
yeah.
So that's what it was, and my sister, there was two movie theaters in town, so my sister managed one, and her boyfriend managed the other one across town. So I got to see movies. Like, I saw Star Wars like 70 times, like literally 70 times.
That's awesome.
And so, yeah, I grew up collecting movie posters and skipping rocks and strange.
Kind of living in your head at that time?
Very much.
I think
living
that
in
that's
my head.
A common thread through all of us is that there's a lot of loner stuff.
Oh, yeah. My wife pulled out this old, I still have. I dare not call them lyric books, but whatever these things were, like from 1986.
I have a book from 1986. it's a green, it's a black composition.
Yeah.
Book with the cardboard cover.
Yeah, I have those books. I have several of those books. That's hilarious. And she's opening this and reading these words, and I'm like, baby, I have to understand. Like, I heard the music in my head. Even though I couldn't play an instrument at the time, these were songs, you know. And then she stumbled across this play I wrote called Living in Purple Worlds. And it must have been right after I saw the Prince movie.
Right.
Because that Prince movie solidified the fact that I need to be a rock star. Like, somehow, I need to do that.
How old were you when that movie came out?
Oh, my goodness. I can't remember the year it came out.
It came out in 84, summer of 84.
Okay. I'm going to be 44 this year.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so we're really the same age.
Right.
I'm 44.
Okay.
And so, yeah. Yeah, you know what's so funny is that that movie is almost like a teenager wrote it. Like, it's so, like, a kid views romance and rock stardom. It's all like a teenager. It's so, like, resonated with, like, you know, I saw that when I was 15, and I was like, yeah,
there's
that's
a
it.
There's a, and I almost hate to admit it, there's a picture of me floating around in a shoebox that I pulled out, and I have, for some reason, I have a Penn State t-shirt on. I have those, like, real short 1980s shorts that nobody should really ever wear.
Nuthuggers.
And And I had like the tube socks.
Yeah.
And I don't know what shoes I was wearing. But I had gone, it was right after the Prince, I had gone out and I found those round Prince mirrored yeah. shades with like the side covers, you know, so you can see through the sides of the glasses. And I have those on, and my hair was like parted in the middle and brown, and just, I was completely normal, except the shades were like this. Yeah. I don't know anything
that was your
about
rock star
me.
Costume.
But this was like my identity. Like, yeah. I knew. My whole family was like, oh, those shades are not you. But I knew that the rest of me was not me.
Right.
The shades were me.
The rest of you had to catch up to the shades. That's amazing.
I just knew it. And I have, funny enough, that's I have Prince to awesome. Thank for that. I it's so weird. But yeah.
He's not on Twitter. So I'd drive him nuts if he was. Dude, you know, speaking of Twitter, I'm going to go back and just say this one thing. I got into this thing where I saw famous people tweeting late at night. Mm-hmm. And I got home from a gig to my hotel in Houston. It was like 3 a.m, and I was kind of drunk. And Nile Rodgers posted, he's got a blog about his cancer and his treatment and what he's going through. And he's doing well now, but at that mm-hmm. point he wasn't doing very well. And it really bummed me out, because I love Nile Rodgers.
Yeah.
I love everything about him. So I wrote him, and I was like, I can't tell you like how sad I am about this. I love you so much, and what you've done, you know, what you've given the world, all this beauty and all this shit. And he wrote me back, and I flipped out.
Wow.
So ever since then, I've been fishing in the middle of the night. I try so hard to write something that's going to resonate with someone. But I did mean it. I mean, it would really touch me.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I love that the prints, the glasses were the thing, and you had to catch up. So did you pick up instruments then, or did you?
No, I mean, I remember my mom getting me a guitar, and then, you know, I pick it up and I realized I couldn't figure out where to put the fingers, and it didn't sound like anything I really wanted to hear. It was like this little a beginner acoustic guitar, I believe, and so I think just as quickly as I picked it up, I put it back down again. And it wasn't until I moved down here, Texas, and a friend of mine invited me over to his house, and he had this elaborate machine called the 4-track. And it blew my mind. I was like, I had never seen such a thing where you could record yourself multiple times. And he had a digital delay pedal.
Oh,
so
my God, yeah.
We had all these, I think, 3 or 4 cassettes of just me speaking, I think, Monty Python gibberish and singing made-up songs with echoes and weird... It was just like a weird drug trip, but I was not on drugs, is basically what it was. So, but a friend of mine, my friend Brian Slagle, he wrote out some chord charts with the little dots where I should put my fingers, and I think let me borrow one of his guitars and sat at home and bashed my way through it until I could EAD. I'm like, okay,
I'm in.
What else do you need?
Yeah. 3 chords and the truth.
Yeah.
So how old were you when you moved here to Texas?
15, 16 years old.
And so what was going on? Your family was religious? Your dad was religious?
My dad was, still is, super religious. And so, yeah, I'd never really known my dad, and I thought, oh, I'll come down and spend a summer vacation in Texas and get to know my father, you know? And... You know, from the minute I stepped off the plane in the back of the car, I realized this is a whole different trip for me here. Because it was never about... I mean, we live next down the block from a Catholic church, but nobody ever was really all about the church thing. And this was going to be church Sundays, Wednesdays, Saturday nights.
No,
I'm not. You know, I made my first communion. I have pictures to prove it.
No, but they were Catholic. Your dad was? Or no?
He was, I think, early on, and now, and when I moved down here in like 85, they were going to a non-denominational kind of a Christian church, and it was like, all right, well, you're going to meet Jesus and friends, and I'm like, I didn't really know what to do. And the next thing I know, I'm literally at a youth group event throwing my Pink Floyd albums into a bonfire. You know, it was like, oh, anything that
was secular.
Did you
know? I mean, were you like, oh, they're right, I gotta get rid of this stuff? Or were you there goes Dark Side of the Moon.
Yeah,
shit.
Like, the wall was...
Oh, man.
That was my hiding place. I mean, that was like my escape.
Of course.
You know? So no, I had no idea about the whole thing. I just didn't realize it. And the 80s were, and I guess it's, I mean, I guess it still is to some effect, but the 80s were this time in the Christian world, the church world, where so many outspoken evangelists and preachers and whatever you want to call these folks, they were all coming down on secular music and Satanism and rock music, and you know, it was
the PMRC.
Just,
it was right the time, 85. The PMRC started, and those weird Judas Priest trials.
Yeah,
Ozzy trials.
Everything, the backmasking on the records. Yeah. You know, it was just completely insane, and I never heard any of that in the music I was listening to. I just heard stories that I felt like I could relate to, or worlds that I wanted to be a part of, but it had nothing to do with any of that stuff.
Yeah.
And I remember I smuggled into my house, because they replaced that with all these Christian rock bands, which I won't name names or anything, but it was just when you're listening to Pink Floyd, there's just no alternative.
There's no Christian band that's going to touch you like that. That's going to speak that kind of truth.
You know, I'm listening to cassette tapes with guys in sweaters and smiles on their faces, you know, and I'm just like, I can't relate to any of this at all. But I had to smuggle in. It was a Simple Minds. Once Upon a Time, and with Alive and Kicking on it and all that stuff. I had to smuggle that into my house. And my dad found it. It was my dad or my stepmother found it. And one day I got home, and they were, like, sitting in the living room with like my jam box. And I had to go through track by track and explain to them what this was. And they had a song on that album called Sanctify Yourself.
Yeah.
Okay?
Sanctify yourself. Sanctify.
But there's a lyric that says, I hope and I pray that maybe one day you'll come back down here and show me the way. I'm like, well, he's not talking about a chick. He's got to be talking about God or whatever. So I'm just like, that was my one. You know, I think it was the only thing on the record that I could go, look, he's singing about God right here. You know, who put Sanctify in their lyrics?
Yeah.
It was just great. But then there was another song on there called Ghost Dancing, which at the time I didn't know what it was about, because I was, I just couldn't think past my own face. But I think it was about Africa or something like that, the troubles in Africa.
Sure.
But my stepmother would sit there, Ghost Dancing, what is this all about? And I'm like, oh my God, I just couldn't explain. Very intimidating to me, and I felt like that kid in the wall. I was just backed into this little corner. I'm like, oh my God, what am I doing? And so was that time I started to smuggle more U2's Joshua Tree, and I'd smuggle this stuff that some kids in the youth group were going, all right, here's some stuff you need to be listening to. And there was a band that was a Christian band, but they were, I mean, I'm sure they... I don't even know if they want me to call on that, but a band called the 77s, which to this day are freaking amazing, California band, and are like legit rockin' band. So anyways, that was like, all right, there's hope in this in this world for me yet, you know.
So what ended up, did you lived there and finished high school or whatever? And
I graduated I never went to college. I went right from high school to living on my own, to getting jobs. And
were you
then,
playing then? Or doing any art or anything?
Oh, I was doing some art, and I was playing for like youth group pizza parties, you know, like the church is having a pizza party tonight. And I was in the church, so I would always write my own music, and the church people would just sit there and I was very intrigued by the God thing. Like, I was so, like I was really intrigued by the Jesus thing and the God thing, whatever the God thing was. And I had so many great questions and so many things I wanted to say. And I had a whole ton of doubts. And I was just all screwed up, which kind of still am now. And I love that. And so I'd sing these songs that are just like... just really weird songs that were like, all right, it's about Jesus, but this is not like a church sing-along.
Right.
You know? And so people would be like, oh, it's Chris. We like Chris. So, yeah. But they couldn't quite figure out where I was coming from.
Right.
Because I didn't know where I was coming from. I'm like, well, if God loves me, why am I throwing all my favorite albums into a fire? You know, and why is my father so... Like, I'm living in a house with this oppressive father and this strange world, and I couldn't... And he would literally, like, make me write... Like, if he didn't like something I did, or I got caught in a lie, or whatever it was, he'd make me write Bible verses out.
Yeah.
Like, as a form of punishment.
Sure.
But at the same time, I could, when I read the Bible for myself, I found this color and poetry in it that I just loved. But then... he would use it as a form of punishment. And so I'd have this sort of a duality into it, and it was really freaked me out. So yeah. I just tried to escape that whole living under my father's roof and doing the church thing just to do the church thing. And then I ended up getting married and making it my own little life, my own little journey for myself, but I stayed in San Antonio.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Because you liked it? You love it?
I think I was just I think I just got comfortable here, you know.
Yeah.
And for better or worse, and at that time, my goodness, as time grew on, I started to play out more, and I started to kind of take it more seriously. We started to make records, you know. We get into the studio and make my first record and start sending off my CD or my tapes at that time, cassette tapes, to Chicago, where I found this magazine back when they used to put out like zines and thing.
Yeah.
And I'd send off my stuff to these zines, and they would actually review it, and I would get inspired. Oh my God, somebody across the United States just reviewed my stuff.
Yeah.
And it just went on from there.
You were recording those in studios and then like setting, what was that stuff? What was the music like then?
The first band I was ever in that was like a legit band was Love Coma.
Right, okay.
And we recorded two records. One in San Antonio, and then we recorded another one in Sacramento, California. We got picked up by a record label.
Oh, that's awesome.
And we made a record in Sacramento and got Mike Rowe from the 77s to produce it, and I'm still so grateful. He's an amazing musician, amazing guitar player, songwriter, all that stuff. And we were living the dream.
Yeah.
You know, literally. And we went on the road and we toured. My goodness, we toured all over the United States and...
In a van?
In a little van, yeah. Just kind of following the buses or following whatever else.
Who all did you tour with then? Like, were there other, sort of indie bands?
There was a lot of indie bands and a lot of, like, Christian bands. We ended up touring with bands and we would always, like, show up and we're like, oh my goodness, we feel so out of place. But we kept on being marketed there because a lot of the lyrics were... either really spiritual or, you know,
right.
Jesus-focused lyrics or something. And so they thought, oh, they must be a Christian band. And right. I just didn't have the energy to fight everybody
off. Isn't that like that Pedro the Lion kind of gets that?
You know, yeah,
it's kind of like a... But he's not. But
I think they were called Burlap to Cashmere. I believe if it's the same artist before Pedro the Lion. And I think they were... saturated in that Christian industry,
and we
everything we can do to try to claw our way out, because we realized, without making everybody in the Christian industry sound like they're all backstabbing hypocrites.
I swear to God, probably there's not like Christian musicians listening to my podcast. Probably.
Oh,
I mean, I'm
but,
sure. Maybe.
I'll just say this is that I think it's dangerous. That if you try to market any kind of spirituality, whether it's Hinduism or Christianity or Buddhism, I just think there's a danger in saying, you know, people in the room saying, okay, you need to put more Jesuses in your song lyrics, and you need to, you know, we need to tone those guitars down, and, you know, because you're playing Christian radio is at that time was a lot of housewives sitting at home ironing or doing whatever they're doing, watching the kids and listening to the radio. Yeah. So all of a sudden, a Love Coma song comes on, and it's going to sound like something very dangerous to, you know, to mainstream Christianity. And we were just like, oh my goodness, this is not where we belong.
And that was the early 90s, early mid 90s?
Yeah, it
93
was,
to when?
93 to 96. I broke up the band in 97. just because I realized we were self-destructing and none of us were really making any money or anything like that.
How are you self just kind of falling out of favor with each other and people not liking each other?
We loved each other as much as we could, you know, being on the road with each other. At that time, it was Chris Dodds, whose longest stint was in Two Tons of Steel after that. He's a great, still great friends with him. Matt Slocum went on to be in Sixpence None the Richer.
Yeah.
You might remember band. Yeah. They had a couple of hits out.
I met him. I know that name.
Matt's a good guy. He's a really, really good guy. And bass player Jeff Duncan. Then we had another guy named Matt Odom, who lives up in Dallas. Really, really good people. I think I broke up the band before we hated each other.
That's good.
And I realized, there's, you know, everyone's getting involved in relationships now, and everyone's having kids, and I'm like, it's time we lay this thing down as a band, because we're not going anywhere. It's taking up all this time, and there's really no money in it.
Yeah.
And there's no way to sustain ourselves. Yeah. So, and no one really fought me on it. I was like kind of willing. If everyone was like, "Oh, Taylor, come on," I was just willing to go, "All right, let's keep it going," because I love the idea of playing with other people that you have that connection with.
Right. 'Cause
doing solo stuff is great, but then like if the crowd isn't into it or whatever,
you're alone up there. Yeah, you're almost like a stand-up comic.
Yeah.
You don't have the other guys to go like, because man, we play gigs that are horrible, you know, some kind of corporate thing where no one gives a shit and we're like in a corner or some stuff. But at least we have each other to look at each other and laugh. But I know that feeling of the solo show where you're like, oh God, dude, are you serious?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was 97. I wrote a couple of tunes, recorded them in a local studio, and went to Nashville again. Here I am. And I was armed with just a few CDs, and I handed them out. And of all the people in the world that got a hold of one, Brent Bourgeois from
Bourgeois Tag.
Remember Bourgeois Tag?
Are you kidding me? Time for talking's over now. Yeah. I guess it's time to let you go.
I met him on a street corner in Nashville. And like 2 weeks later, he calls me up, "Hey, Chris, you want to come up to Nashville and record some songs?" We recorded two songs together up in Nashville.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it was amazing.
He didn't write that song, though, right?
It might have been him and Todd Rundgren.
No, I think Lyle...
Oh, Lyle Workman. Yeah, maybe
I was at a party once, and all these people were playing. I was at a party in L.A., and there was Lyle Workman, and I was like, "Oh, who the fucking guy is?" And he's like, "Well, I wrote this song, blah, blah, blah," and he played some song, and he was like, "Oh," and then... This song I wrote when I was in Bourgeois Tag, and I was like, "Oh, I like that song from Bourgeois Tag. I wonder what song he's gonna play." And he played that song, and I was like, "Oh, wow, you're the man!" I don't know if he co-wrote it or if he wrote it. But
yeah, I have to look at the liner notes again.
Yeah. What was he like to work with? Good guy.
Really good guy. He was a really good guy.
What was going on with him at the time? Because those guys had a good run, 80s, and then just kind of like boom.
Come to find out, he's doing A&R for a Christian record label of all things. So now I'm in a studio called Saltmine Studios in Nashville, and working with great, he brought a little great cast of musicians around me, and we did these two songs, Bright Morning Star and another song called Good Thing. And I loved him. I was really slick, but like he let me play my own guitar on, you know, because I'm a scrappy guitar player, you know what I mean? And I don't expect to be like... I didn't know how I was going to do with a click track in a studio. You know what I mean? You get all that intimidation factor of like, oh my, these guys are legit session players. And here's me. I'm used to just kind of winging it on a punk rock stage somewhere. And so he really wanted me to be a part of these songs, which I thought was great because I didn't want to just sit back on the couch and just kind of watch the music being made.
Right.
And it was awesome. And he sang on both of the songs and really... We had a great time, but then when it came time to do a record deal, they sent me a record deal, and it was like a beginner deal, and I was like, I've already been in a record deal with Love Coma. I just wanted a step up from where I was. I didn't want the moon and the stars. I wanted to own my own publishing. I didn't want to give it all away again, and I'm like, I needed something. I remember the day I called him to turn him down and saying, "Man, I loved that time when we made those two songs, but there's no way I can sign this record contract." And he was bummed. I think he was a little bit angry. I think he really wanted me to be like, yeah, he wanted stoked. This project excited, to, yeah, to be like the thing. And at the same time, like days later, I got a record contract from a little label that only had one artist, and they needed like another artist to make them legit,
right,
or something like that. And they
Where
were
was
called
this label?
Rhythm House Records.
Okay.
And they gave me like, we got, you know, like $50,000 to do a record. We want you to do a record with us. You have complete creative control over it. Blah blah. And I was just like, I can't pass this up. Oh yeah. My God. So I went back to Nashville, made Down Goes the Day in 1998. I'm sure it sold next to nothing, but it won some awards or whatever. And then, like a couple years later, I'm in the studio again in Nashville, same record label, working with Rick Elias, who was one of my favorite musicians. And he wrote some tunes on that Thing You Do soundtrack.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and all of a sudden it was like, oh my God, and I made an album called Worthless Pursuit, and that was like those two records are my two big Nashville, big budget rockin' records. I still, to this day, love those records, so.
Do you own those records?
I do.
You got them back.
Yeah,
They're on Bandcamp. People can go there and check them out.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. That's a great story.
I have been so fortunate. And I got to make two records, you know, Down Goes the Day was full of long, moody songs that I love dearly, and I just was so grateful I got to make that kind of record with those musicians. And then, you know, and I was so completely clueless, you know, we're out to lunch with the musicians on that record, and I'm like, so, like, the guy next to me who is singing vocals in the vocal booth, so what other records have you been on? He's like, well, I just got done doing some stuff with Paul McCartney, and I sing a lot with Kenny Loggins and play guitar for him, and I'm like, really? I had, you know, completely no idea. And I'm like, what in the world are you doing on my record? You know, like, what? How did you?
God's got to work, man.
How did you get here?
Your Wednesday session. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but I'll tell you, they were amazing, and they loved. They got a chance to do stuff on my record that they said they've never been able to do. They really let loose and be creative and loads of fun. So that was awesome, just to have those experiences working with those guys, and
And then you came back here and put out just a series of independent records.
I just decided it's time to sort of take matters in my own hands and really figure out what I can do on my own.
Right.
At that time, it was so tough. It was so great to come back with these massive records made in Nashville with the most amazing session players. And then you come back home and you're like, oh, I'm playing Tycoon Flats with my buddies who don't know how to play this kind of music, who can't play these licks, who don't know how to, you know, they're just freestyling it over everything. And then you realize, oh, wow, like you can't reproduce your own record, you know? And so
you're anchored, that's not right.
I decided I want to make records that'll sound like me. Like if I go play in a bar somewhere, it's going to sound like me playing in a bar somewhere, you know what I mean, or whatever.
So how did it go?
And not feel bad about it. I want to write music with anybody telling me how to do it, and I want to figure out how to produce myself. Like I know what I hear in my head. I always hear a finished song. I always know there should be an orchestra on this song, or if there should be a drummer playing a garbage can, or I always know that.
Yeah.
But when you're working with producers and you don't really know them and they don't really know you, they're just doing their job, you know, sometimes you get intimidated and you don't want to say, I mean, what they're doing is really cool and all, but...
Yeah, can you make it not sound so shiny?
Yeah,
I know that.
So now it was just me going, all right. It was me and I think, you know, I love listening to your podcast. I've heard a lot of episodes, and I love it. And my wife and I, like, a lot of times we'll be eating spaghetti dinner on the table and be like, bah, bah, bah,
bah, bah, bah.
Oh, and we're like, oh, man, we just love it. And so I thought, man, if I'm ever on this podcast, you know, what would... Because my story, I didn't know if my stories would mean anything to anybody listening, tuning in, going, you know, who the hell is Chris Taylor? Why bother? What's the point? Next, I'm going to go to Shania Twain or somebody else I might know, heard of. And I think the one thing that I would want to stress that I think any musician or anybody in their job for that matter, is to find the joy in what they do. And I think making music on my own, in my own room, in my own creative space, making my own records, trying and failing at sounds and trying and failing at arrangements and songs and whatever it is, it's like I discovered the joy in what it is I do.
Yeah.
And I discovered the joy in not worrying about if everybody else likes it or not.
Yeah.
Or if your friends are like, dude, why is that? Why are you doing the weird drum loop synth thing now? Like, I don't understand. Like,
right, right.
None of that matters. It's about going, you know what? It's like my own creative time now, and I get to find that joy. And once you find the joy, and you really are passionately involved in whatever it is you're creating, and once you put it out there, whether you're putting it out there in a live setting or whether you do it on your record and you release it somewhere, then whether you get any praise or whether you get ignored, none of that really, really matters, because your goal's already been accomplished. You know, you've got it out. Yeah, you've got it out of you.
Yeah.
And you have that really great feeling of being joyful throughout the whole process.
Yeah.
To where some records you look back on and they're like bad snapshots of your... All you remember is the fight you got in with the producer, or the drummer was pissed because he didn't want to play this way, or whatever it is. And you're like, you can't even listen to the song anymore because those are the only memories you have.
Right, right. But then when you do this stuff, I know exactly what you mean. Like, I don't listen to anything that I recorded in 1995 in a studio, but I listen to all my 4-track shit from then, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because there's just something weird about it. And you know, you're getting your point across in a way that you want to, you know?
Yep.
So, tell me about the postcards from the end of time. That's your latest record.
It's my latest record.
And you put out 2 records this year.
Yeah, I did.
Prolific.
One I had to record because I was clawing my way out of depression. I mean, it was like, I went to like this, like 2012 was like the dark year of my life, you know what I mean? It was just like really insane dark. And that's a whole other podcast for a whole other time, you know? And to the point where I was literally laying in bed and couldn't get out of bed anymore. Like, I just, even the thought of me going down and pouring coffee seemed surreal. Yeah. Seemed like, why bother with any of that crap?
Yeah.
And all I can say is this. When something happens in your life, when it happens to you, when an outside force or something happens to you that is horrible, then it causes you to recoil, but you can kind of, you still have your wits about you because you go, man, this thing that's happening to me is horrible, but you have your center, or hopefully you at least have your center, whatever it is that keeps you grounded in you. But when you sort of sabotage yourself and inadvertently hurt the people that you love the most and the people that are closest around you, that's what I was dealing with me. I have no one to blame but myself for this weird darkness and this sabotage.
Yeah.
So the idea of, you know, writing songs to me seemed like such a ridiculous concept. Like, why, like, dude, who the hell do you think you are? And I mean, like, what are you even bothering for? And so I had to force myself to write, and that was what became Frame the Light and Stranger's Clothes. And then Postcards from the End of Time was me saying, all right, forgive yourself and start living again. Like, live, breathe, learn how to do things that you do without that weird darkness in the back of your mind. Like, you can't hang on to that forever. It's going to kill you.
Yeah.
So Postcards to me was like this record of saying, you know what? It's okay to laugh again. It's okay to laugh at things that are funny, or to make yourself laugh, or to have a life.
Yeah.
And so I would start writing tunes, and I literally had a week to myself, and I wrote and recorded everything within a week.
Wow.
And just put it out.
Must have been a great feeling at the end of that week.
It was awesome.
So much out, you know.
It was awesome feeling. It was a week of the big rain, thunderstorms. There's only a few of them in the last year or so. And I remember sticking the microphone outside, capturing the thunder and
how you doing?
Good, bud.
Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Sort of including all of that stuff in the process of making this record. You know,
these two are
awesome.
Oh, sorry, we'll move down if you want.
No, Judge, you're fine.
Oh, good. Thank you.
We've got other people coming, but they won't be here until later.
All right, we're just wrapping up.
You're good.
So,
this is
I'm glad to hear that you found a way to work it out, because that's tough, and I've gone through periods like that, and you know, there are things that bring you out of it, and it's always being able to fight fear.
Yeah.
By making art, you know what I mean? And you're able to work out the things that are keeping you back, and then you were able to even take it a step further and start moving forward.
Yeah.
You know?
It's not an easy thing to do, and I think I'm still going through it, but you know, you do see the light at the end of the tunnel, and you know, and it's not always the train, but the greatest feeling in the world is being able to sit back and enjoy the people around you and enjoy the fact that you are exactly who you are, and what was meant to happen is exactly what was meant to happen.
Yeah.
And for some weird reason, in 2012, I couldn't see it, and I still don't even really know why, but I know the people that are around me now are closer to me than ever before.
Yeah.
And the people that no longer want to be in my life or no longer associate with me or talk to me or whatever the thing may be, the people that mysteriously haven't shown up at my gigs in the last year and a half, I'm at peace with that now. I used to be like so paranoid over the whole thing, and now I'm like, you know what? It is what it is.
Yeah.
And you just sort of move on, and you use whatever silly chords and lyrics that you can get out of your system as a way of healing yourself. And if you're lucky, or blessed, maybe a way of healing other people along the way too. And that builds a little bit of a community of people that connect to what you do and who you are as a person, you know? So that's a pretty cool thing.
Man, that's amazing what's going on with your art. You're doing a lot of
It seems like I'm doing a lot more now. All of a sudden, like out of the blue in the last literally couple months, people have been coming out of the woodwork saying, oh, commission a piece for here, and I love this, and or they're just buying stuff that I've just done.
Yeah.
And it's weird because I don't make prints, so like I'll get really attached to a piece, and then somebody will want to buy it, and I'll be like, well, I must pay rent.
Yeah.
And so there it goes. And it's like this exhilarating feeling of like, I can't believe I'm selling my artwork.
Yeah.
And then, oh my God, that piece is gone. I'll never see it again. You know, it's like this very surreal thing, but I'm so grateful. I'm so grateful that I get to do what I love to do and barely make it, but make it.
Yeah.
You know, like I could be working a really crap job and not even making as much as if I sold two paintings. You know, it's just crazy.
My brother, I was in Miami in January, and he's like a real, like, he reads like goal books and stuff, like, you know, those kind of things. And he's real structured. He has business ideas, and he's in a business school right now, and he's getting his MBA and all this stuff. But we were driving, he was like, do you ever get bummed out that you never made it? And I was like, what is making it? Like, I make music, and I pay everything doing it. Like, I did not make it. I mean, I'm not Paul McCartney, but I mean, fuck.
Yeah.
You know? People hug me when they see me.
Yeah. It's a it's such a beautiful thing.
And
like, I just get a call the other day, and do you know Will Sexton?
Of
He's
course.
An Austin guy, and he and I connected a few years back through a song of mine called Better.
Uh-huh.
It turns out it's one of his favorite songs of mine, which is really cool. And he calls me up, and we might be doing a show together in Austin, and I he's got like this secret band that he's forming with some people.
Yeah, I know.
So yeah. I might be a part of this show, and I'm.
That's awesome.
And I just I'm like, how did I get here?
Yeah.
Like, I'm just literally.
I'm not going to talk about it on here, but people have talked about it on this show. They've talked about that secret band. It's a weird lineup of people.
Yeah. Who would have thought?
No one. So I do have one thing to say before we get out of here. First of all, people can find you ChrisTaylorWorld.com.
Correct.
And your Bandcamp is Bandcamp/ChrisTaylor?
What is Chris Taylor dot Bandcamp .com, I think is what it is.
Okay, so but if they go to Chris Taylor World, everything's there.
Yeah.
Artwork, music stuff.
Yes.
I like you, man. I'm glad that you reached out and you were like, hey, and I was like, oh, cool. Well, I'm going there, tomorrow.
That's
Let's
awesome.
Do this.
Yeah.
Because sometimes it's hard to line it up. And we've talked. I think we've talked about it before, but it was a while back.
Right.
Or maybe you said something. I can't remember. But you grew into the sunglasses. The rest of you is there.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. You're there with the sun. You're
and
you
now
got the whole suit.
Yeah. Now people can't. They don't see the kid with the hair parted in the middle and the tube socks. You know. Which
Although
is weird.
I think you should be wearing nuthuggers.
Maybe I should. Yeah.
I don't know. It would make the party better. So people should get out there. They can get your music. A lot of it's for free on Bandcamp.
You can download a lot of stuff for free. Pay what you want. They can definitely listen to it all before they decide. So, it's like a grab bag and take a little bit off everything.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, thanks, man. I'm really glad that. And we should still do some shows and shit together
at some point.
I haven't been playing many solo shows in Austin. And when I have, I've opened for people. But maybe we can get something. Do you come up there any at all?
My wife and I love to come to Austin, okay. So we're there.
All right.
We're there, and it doesn't take us much to get there if need be. So, yeah, give us a call.
Well, thank you, Chris. Everyone get out there, buy the records, pay what you want, and thanks.
Very welcome. Cheers. Thank you.
Sorry, it got a little loud there at the end, but man, Chris Taylor is a great guy. What a great story. Great guy, great musician, and great songwriter, and he is also a fantastic visual artist. I'd like to thank him again for the beautiful painting that he made me, which I'm looking at right now in my studio. That was a great talk in Bourne, Texas, out on a porch. People started showing up, and then I played a gig. All right, thank you to Chris Taylor. Get out there. Go check out ChrisTaylorWorld.com. See the visual stuff. Listen to the music, get into it, and follow him on Twitter. While you're there, follow me on Twitter, at Johnny Gowdy. You can also follow me on Instagram, also at Johnny Gowdy. Like our Facebook page, How Did I Get Here? Also, subscribe to us on iTunes. Leave a comment, leave a rating. Please, helps with advertising sales. And we're going to get down right now with the song that Chris Taylor wrote with Dave Stewart. We talked about it on here a lot. And this is the song, Here and Gone. Let's get down. Chris Taylor, do it.
To be the heartbreaker or heartbroken, wherever you are, become the soul of that place. You've got to see all the angels in the eyes of mere strangers. The whole world is their stage. I'm feeling like an orphan, I'm searching for my soul, walking in and out of traffic while I'm falling down a hole. I'm here and gone, but ever. Where I wanna be.